Blind Nil Audio.
Today on 50 Fires, you'll hear my conversation with Manit Chauhan.
I do think that people who are financially secure are people who never stop being hungry. Not greedy, hungry.
Manit is known as one of the judges on Chopped.
In front of the TV, there's always smoke and mirrors.
And she also runs some fantastic restaurants in Nashville.
The proof is always in the pudding. My reputation is more important than the financial aspect. I know that I'm going to work probably forever because it nourishes my soul.
We're going to talk about it today on 50 Fires. Greetings, Carl here. One of my goals with 50 Fires has always been to have conversations that remind me or make me think about money in a different way. And I was so excited to talk to Manit because Manit was born and raised in India. And the stories that she tells about India are so deep and so rich that they've changed the way I think about money. Now, Manit is known as a celebrity chef from being a judge on Chopped and many of the other Food Network shows. One thing I'm super excited about, and I haven't made it happen yet, but I'm going to Nashville because our producer, Chris, actually went to Nashville to make this recording happen. And afterwards, he ate, and he sent me a picture of the food he ate at Manit's flagship restaurant, Chauhan Masala and Ale House. There were a bunch of things in this conversation that literally changed my mind. But the one thing that I'm most excited about is this deep sense of joy and reverence that Manit approaches money with. I'm Carl Richards, an author, an artist, and a proud financial planner. And today we're talking about money with Manit Chauhan. This is 50 Fires, a podcast about money and meaning.
Hello, Carl. How are you doing?
I'm great, Manit. How are you?
Fantastic.
What did they tell you about this? How did they convince you to do this crazy thing?
They asked me. I said yes.
Very good.
You know, this is one of my biggest problems. Actually, I don't see it as a problem. I love saying yes to everything because I have realized that every time you say yes to something, you discover a completely new aspect.
Yeah.
I mean, I said yes once to being in a Hallmark movie, right? So I get myself into enough trouble by saying yes, and I thoroughly enjoy getting into trouble.
Yeah, trouble is good. So I'm really curious about your earliest memory of money.
Early on, both my sister and me, we were taught the importance of money, right? And to us, it was very clear. Both mom and dad told us, listen, the only thing that we can leave for you is a good education. There isn't money coming for you. And especially growing up in India as a girl child who weren't prized, right, in the society.
Yeah.
Both my parents.
Did you hear that? Like, we are 3 minutes into a conversation and Manit has already said something that stuck with me, right? This idea of being a girl child in India. I have so much respect and admiration for the energy that she brings to that discussion because of the conversation she was having with her parents, right? There's no money. I think she said, there's no money coming for you, but you're going to get an education so you can do this. Hearing Manit talk like that reminded me of a feeling I often have about my 3 daughters and my wife and the strength with which I see them approaching these subjects. In fact, I remember my wife saying, the man is not the plan, to my daughters.
Both my parents, they looked at both of us and they said that you secure your independence through financial independence. You know, never be in a situation where you're financially dependent on anyone.
Right.
You know, I grew up in this really small town in India. It's called Ranchi. My dad, an engineer. My mom, she was a teacher, and then she became a principal of a school. And we grew up surrounded with people whose economic status was completely like us, and like a very average middle class family, right? And it's really interesting now in hindsight, when I look back, I realize how much we didn't do because of, you know, our economic standing in our lives, But not for a minute did I ever think of that as a kid. So, I mean, you know, it used to be simple things. On Sunday, one of my favorite memories, Sunday mornings, my dad, he used to have a scooter, right? A two-wheeler. And a Sunday, I would go with him to the farmer's market. And each and every place where we would stop, there would be bargaining going on. Right? Like onions. Oh, onions are 50 rupees. So 50 rupees. And then my dad would say that, so expensive. Right? So there used to be that constant bargaining going on, which I think in a way has also seeped into me. In India, you know, at that time, you just wouldn't buy anything just at the price told. You would bargain. It used to be this game where there was that going on. One of the most fascinating things that my dad did. He's a very meticulous, he's an engineer, so very meticulous person. Every day, wherever we would go out, he would come back, he had a diary. Okay. The diary had each and every date written. And whatever he spent, whatever anybody in the family spent, was written down over there.
Wow.
Right?
Are those still around? Your father's notebook that he wrote?
You know, when I go back to India, I'll definitely ask him.
If we were to open one, let's say we opened one now that was 20 years ago, what would it tell us about your father's values in terms of how he spent his money?
I think a lot of it was a very modest living. I don't recall being told no for anything. But I also do recall that the way we were raised, that we didn't ask for things which were unreasonable. Like, they weren't indulgences, right? Like, my dad loves to travel. You know, there would be times that he would be like, okay, it's the Easter holidays, great. We've got 4 days off. Let's sit in the car and let's drive to the beach.
Do you think, looking back on this, because this is really interesting to me, you mentioned you grew up in, I think you used the term sort of average middle class, but everybody else around you was the same?
Yeah.
Do you feel like that had some role in this idea of not ever feeling like there was something you weren't getting? Like, everybody was kind of doing the same. You didn't have a lot of access to, you know, the Kardashians on a plane. You know, you like the Instagram.
Absolutely. I mean, I think I must have been 8 or 9 when we got our first TV, right? Which was this small black and white. And in India, it would only, like, there would be only one show which would come after the news, between the Hindi and the English news. So there wasn't a lot that we were exposed to. What was happening around in our community, that's what was available, right? And at that time...
Hey, it's Carl again. I want you to notice something. And I've been thinking a lot about this since the conversation I had with Manit. Notice the impact of the community that you surround yourself with in terms of money. It turns out peer pressure is a real thing. And we say silly things like, oh, I would never try to keep up with the Joneses. But the people that you surround yourself with and the messages that you're taking in have a real impact on how you treat money. So one thing you could think about is to be very careful and intentional about curating who you're hanging out with when it comes to money. And by who you're hanging out with, I mainly mean, what messages are you allowing into your life? What do you see on Instagram, right? Because that causes huge problems with our money. And keeping up with the Joneses is not in your face. It's this little insidious problem. You just sort of notice somebody else doing something and then you think, well, why don't I do that too? You often hear people say you become the average of the 4 people you spend the most time with. That's true with money too.
And at that time also, India was a closed market. We weren't getting a lot of things coming in from overseas. I remember the first time I spent 50 rupees and got a can of Coke.
You remember that?
I remember that because 50 rupees was a lot, right? And a can of Coke, you couldn't get it in the town that I was, where I grew up. But we never saw cans. Right? We only had those bottles and Coke, it was not available in India. So to me, I'm like, oh my God, I'm getting something overseas, like from foreign for my sister, right? And it was like with so much pride, I got it for her. And we did not open that can forever because we were like, you know, this is prized. Like this is expensive, it's prized. But it's interesting how the perspective changes.
Just before that, if you had to describe your relationship with money growing up in one word, like what would you use? Your relationship to money in that sort of younger childhood phase of your life? What word would you use?
Modest. Yeah. But you know, what was really fascinating was since the time we were really young, both my sister and I, we had bank accounts. You know, dad, we had those checkbooks. Dad taught us how to write checkbooks, how to sign on that. He would take us to the bank to deposit or withdraw. Because, you know, it's really interesting in the Indian culture when people meet you for the first time, you know, relatives meet you for the first time, they give you money, which is, you know, considered a blessing, which happens in a lot of other cultures also, like Chinese culture, etc., right? So that money which would come, we would not spend it.
Isn't that interesting that the gift of money you relate immediately to, like, considered a blessing?
Yes.
Super interesting.
Yeah. And that's, there is a word in Hindi, which is shagun, which is also something that we've named our daughter because it means blessings. Mm. But usually that could be in terms of like, okay, like somebody's getting married. Okay, this is a shagun for you. Like it could be money, it could be gift, it could be anything. Mm. But it's always put in terms of blessings.
How old were you when you went away from the small town that you were living in?
To do my undergrad, and I was, I think, 18.
Okay. And where did you go?
So I went in southern India. There is a town called Manipal, and I went to do my hotel administration over there. I did my bachelor's over there.
So you go away to school. Were you aware when you got to outside of the small town? Were you aware of your socioeconomic class in this new setting?
Acutely.
How? Tell me how.
A lot of my friendships were formed because of the socioeconomic class that everybody belonged in, right? Like the really rich kids, I had nothing in common with them, right? Like, you know, they were cars and they were scooters and all of that. I did not get that at all, right? And so even like our friend group was people who were very similar, like, you know, similar background as mine, similar economic, like even if we had to go out, right, instead of going to this really fancy place, we would go to this cafe and order one chai and then, you know, divide it among the four of us. And we're like, okay, you know, so I think that was really fun. I also do think that it made us a lot more creative in figuring out how we could find our place. You know, we used to take these really cheap buses to the beach. And then, of course, like, you know, buy one beer, which we would like bury under the sand in the water so that it would become nice and chilled. And then like the four of us like having a beer each, and you're like, you know, so yeah, those were the memories.
Are there any stories that come to mind of that? Like how you sorted yourself out, like the fact that you found each other, you knew those were the rich kids and this is my people. Like, do you remember? That's super interesting to me. How did you know?
I think, again, through food.
Oh, really?
It was, to me, I think a lot of this is because of food.
Oh, such a surprise.
I know. Surprise, surprise. But I think it was through food. It was the fact that, you know, we would be like, I would love to go and dine. You know, street food is my jam. And not only because of how flavorful it is, I really respect the entire art of it. Because if you think about it, these street food vendors have such limited resources. And they can coax these flavors out of such limited resources is something which, like, I have mad respect about. So that's, you know, that's how literally it started. Like, oh, I'm going to go and get some street food. Do you want to come along with me? Yes. So that's how it started. And that's how we started exploring.
So you go to undergraduate there. You, at some point, you make your way over to the States for another culinary school, right?
So, yeah. So when I was in my final year, I was just about to graduate from bachelor's. I went and I asked one of my instructors, which was the best culinary school in the world to go to. And without even batting an eyelid, he said, the Culinary Institute of America, which is in upstate New York. And that was it. I'm like, okay, this is it. I'm going to apply. So the interesting part is that my sister had already, she's my older sister. She was doing her, she did her bachelor's in engineering, and she came here to Indiana University to do her master's. And she came here on a scholarship. At the CIA, you really don't get any of those. So that was really, really interesting because I really wanted to go to the CIA. It's really expensive. My parents did not have the financial means, but my sister had just graduated. So I came over here and we have a lot of relatives around, but you cannot ask for financial help from relatives unless you really need to. And my sister, she had gotten her first credit card and she had started working for Motorola at that time. She paid for my first semester on her credit card.
Wow.
Right? That's how I pretty much started. Wow. And then once I was there, I literally applied for everything. I became the RA, so I did not have to pay for living or, residence. I would volunteer with each and every chef. So that meant that on weekends, my food was taken care of. Otherwise, you would have to pay for food during the week, weekends. Also, being the RA, when the new students would come, there would be this copious amount of pizza and wings, which I would freeze. And whenever I was hungry, I would have that.
Wait, just a second. Let me double check something. So you said the copious amounts of pizza and wings, you would eat some and then you would freeze. Like it was your food storage.
That was my food storage. Yes.
In like you had it in a freezer and.
I bought a small, those small refrigerators, like I think for $25, somebody who was leaving, which was a lot for me.
Right.
Because I when I came from India, I was making in a month, I was making around 5,000 rupees, which at that time translated was $100 a month. Mm. So $25 was a lot, right? And a microwave for $5. That also I bargained with, because there were students who were leaving and leaving. I'm like, you're going to throw it. So give it to me. I'll give you five, right?
Yeah.
Then there used to be job postings. I mean, I remember there was one job where all I did was, it was a racetrack somewhere in, Connecticut. And for 10 hours, all I was doing was frying fries. Mm. And when I took a break and I came out and I'm looking, there were these, Boxsters, these Porsche Boxsters. And I looked at it and I'm like, one day I'm going to own these, right? Right. And, many years down, my husband is like, what's your dream car? And I, bought a Porsche Cayenne. And I'm like, if you will it, the whole world will conspire to make sure that you achieve what you've set for yourself.
I want to ask you about that quote, if you will it. I'm super interested in this because it seems to be a theme among these conversations. Do you know people now that walk around talking about manifesting, and there's a really true, incredibly valuable piece of the law of attraction. And then there's the childish piece that's like the universe will just provide. Have you thought about that? How do you separate? Because there seems to be an awful lot of hard work involved in every single story you're telling me. And do you notice sometimes the people missing the hard work part and just thinking I will just manifest. I'll have my dream board and my vision board. And I thought about a Porsche Boxster. So there's going to be one in the driveway tomorrow morning.
More so than not. You've just opened a Pandora's box over here. Because
I'm excited.
I am literally the amount of time that I spend, I'm starting to sound like an old lady that these kids nowadays, right?
But off my lawn.
The truth of the matter is that it's important to have goals. It's very important to have goals. Right. But one of the biggest things is that there needs to be a follow through. Let's say I want to have this steak, right? It's not going to come in front of you. You've got to go. You've got to buy the ingredients. You've got to figure out how to make it. You've got to put some talent in it. You've got to, there is some heat involved. You've got to make it if you want something. And to me, I think that's the most important thing. It's important to have goals. It's important to have visions. But if there's no follow through, nothing is going to come to you, right? Mm-hmm. Nothing comes to anybody, right? Even if you look at somebody who's got everything in this world, right? That person has to work doubly hard to make sure that they keep everything and they grow that. So nothing is going to come to anybody who is lazy and not putting in the effort, period, right?
No matter how good you are at being manifesty and waving your hands.
You can manifest all you want. There is no fairy godmother, right? The only fairy godmother is the one which you create in yourself.
Hey, I've got to jump in here because as Manit really carefully, like the conversation really carefully points out, there's a juvenile version, like a childish version of the law of attraction where we just sit around and manifest and hope things show up. This is one of my all-time pet peeves. It was first popularized, unfortunately, among millions and millions of people in this book, The Secret, which I think actually has done more damage, more harm in people's relationship with money than any other single book. But there's something really valuable and important and true about the law of attraction when combined with work. And then at the end, there's still this like bit of mystery that we don't understand. And so there is no, as Manit says, there is no fairy godmother. And you can manifest all you want and wave your hands in the air and do your sun salutations in the morning. And that stuff's important. But there's still some element of work. And then there's also still some element of luck involved in things working out.
And take each and every opportunity, no matter how small that opportunity is. And that goes back to that conversation of, you know, the yes conversation that we were talking about earlier. The reason why I say yes is because you never know what opportunities come out of a conversation, right? You never know what opportunities come out of, you know, just going and doing something. And maybe nothing comes out of it.
Right.
But what have you lost, right? And that to me is the reason why I say yes, because even when I, you know, there were times that I did not have, you know, now everybody's like, oh, she's on TV, she's this, she's that. Do you know that that is the tip of the iceberg? You're not seeing the 90% of the sweat, the tears, the blood.
The frozen pizza.
Yeah, into making who I am. I mean, they were like literally times when I didn't have work on weekends. I would go and buy the 1 liter Sprite, right? And a packet of chips. And 2 days, that was what food was for me, right? Whatever was the cheapest, like $2. Okay, great. I would walk all the way, even in winter. It was around a 2 mile walk to ShopRite.
Uphill both ways.
No, it wasn't uphill. It was rolling hills.
Yeah, right. So there was uphill both ways.
Absolutely. Good. But you know what? That resulted in the person who I've become right now.
Yeah.
I mean, and that doesn't stop. Like yesterday I was cooking for 2,000 people. My day started at 5 in the morning and the event finished at 12 in the night. And you do it. And I don't begrudge it because to me, the amount that I learned, even though it was so much work from yesterday's event, it made me start thinking of how to streamline a lot of things that I am doing. So each and every experience leaves me enriched. It could be financially, it could be experience, it could be connections. It's always a win-win.
We'll be right back with more from 50 Fires. Hey, it's Carl. You know what's hard for most of us? Talking money. That's what I'm talking about. Talking about money is hard for most of us, but there's somebody who it is not hard for. She's been doing it forever. Her name is Shauna Game. And if you've been enjoying the conversations I'm having here at 50 Fires, I think you would love what Shauna's got going on at her podcast. The podcast is called Everyone's Talkin' Money. And just like 50 Fires, Shauna's goal with Everyone's Talkin' Money is to go beyond the spreadsheets and the calculators and the budgeting apps to talk about how our emotional relationship with money impacts our lives. With over 900 episodes, that's right, 900, there is an episode for any and every practical money question you have. Some of Shauna's recent episodes include retirement risks to avoid and credit card versus debit card. Which one should I use? You're going to love it. Subscribe to Everyone's Talking Money on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Welcome back to 50 Fires. Tell me about getting out of school. I'm super curious. We can fast forward almost to, I'm really curious about the process of deciding to take the risk of your own restaurants.
Oh, getting out of school was really, really tough. Yeah, because, you know, I had graduated, I have my bachelor's from the best school in India. And then I have, you know, I've graduated from the best culinary school in the world. The world should be my, you know, like, right. It should be mine, right?
Right.
And at the CIA, there were 3 awards which were given to our class. And I was that, I got each and every, highest GPA, everything. I had put in my work. Now I'm like, oh, people will come knocking on my door, right? That didn't happen because in our industry, sponsorship of paperwork was close to impossible.
And by paperwork, you mean like the ability
immigration.
To work, like visa, immigration.
Yeah, visa, immigration, that kind of stuff. So I would apply for jobs and these are chefs that I looked up to, right? Like chefs who I really wanted to work with and they're like, yes, absolutely, we'll give you a job. Look at all of this is incredible. And then as soon as I would broach the topic of paperwork, drop me like a hot potato. And till that time, all my education was in baking and pastry arts because I wanted to be this amazing cake maker because in India, you didn't see that, right? So I got really desperate about it. Like, what am I going to do? Because, you know, applied everywhere, even applied as, you know, baker at ShopRite, like whatever, right? Nothing coming through. But this is when you think that, you know, when things are meant to happen, they do, right? As long as you put your work in it. So my uncle and aunt in South Jersey, they were opening a Indian restaurant very close to Philadelphia. And they are like, listen, till the time you don't get anything else, if you want, you can work over here. We'll sponsor your paperwork. We are looking for people. We are looking for, you know, managers, etc. You know, this is what it is. I'm like, okay, great. I'll work there for a little bit. And, you know, while I'm looking for things and, you know, win-win situation. That little bit was 4 years. But those 4 years, I think, were the most formative years of my career because when I walked into that place, I'm like, Indian restaurant, who wants to work in an Indian restaurant? Like, right? You've grown up with that around you and you're like, please, this is so pedestrian, right? And you are like, you want to be the next, like, you know, Thomas Keller or whatever, right? And you're like, this Indian restaurant is not going to get me there. But that opened my eyes to the dismal perception that people had of Indian food in America. And I'm like, this is not it, right? Grew up on 3 fresh meals. They are flavorful. There is so much of seasonality, everything. You guys are talking about farmers market. Those were the only markets we went to, right? So all of this was really eye-opening to me. And I think that is where I started seeing an opportunity for myself for the future. So from a 70-seater, we expanded the place to 140-seater.
Wow.
So not only was I a part of the opening crew, I was also a part of the expansion crew. when we started off, there was a manager, but he didn't last too long. I took over the management of the entire thing. So I was managing the place. I was managing a kitchen full of Indian chefs, all of them men, all of them my parents' age, and I had to make them work and listen to me. So I developed leadership skills without being like getting people to do work with you without pissing them off and without being too bossy about it, right? You get your work done. I started really figuring out how Indian food can be taken to the next level. So it was such a gift to me. And that is when that switch really started happening. And then I used to have a Mazda Miata, which I used to call my pre-Porsche. So this is the halfway point to getting my Porsche. Right. And my sister was in Chicago. So I, you know, after 4 years, I'm like, this is it. I need to do something. Drove to Chicago, went and I knocked, like, you know, there were a couple of restaurants that I really liked. I'm like, can I stage over here? And I staged. And because of that, I got an executive chef position, you know, in Chicago. That again, they opened an outpost in New York, came to New York, got married, you know, somewhere in the process of that entire, you know, couple of years. And when I was expecting my first child, my daughter, that's the time I was like, first of all, knowing that it's a daughter, I'm like, I need you to be, you know, like a go-getter. Because whatever said and done, growing up in India and still over here, there still is an inequality to, you know, there's a gender bias, right? And to me, I think that made me stronger. I'm like, you are going to rule. So that's the time that I decided that I'm going to start a business of my own. So literally started with a company called Indie Culinaire LLC, which was like, you know, I did... consulting work. I did, you know, I wrote my book, did a book tour, did a lot of collaborations, etc. And then, you know, Chopped had started taking off, started getting phone calls, which was, I think, the second or the third season. And then they invited me to be a permanent judge on Chopped.
Is that when, like, financially, when did things start to change for you?
Isn't financial change really relative to where you find yourself?
For sure.
Right? To me, I'm like, okay, so I can afford a really good designer purse right now. But how am I doing financially, right? So I think it's a matter of perspective. I do think that people who are financially secure are people who never stop being hungry, right? Not greedy. Greedy is something completely different. Hungry.
Hey, it's me again. I actually don't know what to make of that last statement that Manit just made, that people who are financially secure are people who never stop being hungry. There's something intriguing about that idea, and I'm not exactly sure what to make of it. Manit's not pointing, as she clarified, to greedy. And I also think Manit is pointing to something else, and you can hear it in her voice. Hungry is not heavy. There's a sense of joy and playfulness when she uses the word hungry. And so I think there's something really important there. And I'd love to hear what you think about this idea that people who are financially secure are the people who never stop being joyfully hungry. And by the way, it's not lost on me that she's a chef and using the word hungry.
To me, that hunger is there and it always will be.
Why the hunger? I will never stop being hungry. Why that?
Because that's what drives me.
But is it related to money?
Not really.
Or it's just related? What is it related to?
Not really. I don't think that it's an accumulation of money. But whatever I do, when you get a financial reward, right? You know that you've been acknowledged for the work that you have put in.
It's almost just a measuring stick of the quality of the, like the art, if you will.
In my mind, yes. In my mind, yes. It's a reward. You know, whatever we do, we are humans in the end of the day, right? We expect a return, right? Now a return can be in terms of like in personal relationships, right? It's that return is in form of affection or, you know, the connection that you get. But in work, that reward is in form of the emoluments that you get, right? And I don't think that it is only, you know, it's only the dollar amount, but there is, you know, the recognition. But with the recognition, the dollar amount goes up, then the recognition. So it's hand in hand.
So the hunger never goes away. The CHOP things happen. Tell me about a time, like what was the scariest bet you had to make on yourself?
I think opening the first restaurant, Chauhan Ale and Masala House. I think that was really because that was putting a part of you out there. You know, there is in front of the TV, there's always smoke and mirrors, right? But the proof is always in the pudding. Literally that is when people walk into the restaurant and they've heard so much about you and they leave disappointed. You know, that is something which to me is, you know, my reputation is more important than, you know, the financial aspect of things. And because, you know, if you've got a good reputation, people will come, more money, blah, blah, blah. Again, the same thing, you know, hand in hand. So I think that was the toughest thing to do is put yourself out there. It's, you know, and it was an interesting time for us because we were living in New York. My husband had his own businesses. The 6-month project took 2 years. Along the way, we found out we were expecting baby number two. Wow. Baby number two decided to be born 3 months early the day we opened the restaurant.
Stop.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
So, but that
like
was
the day you opened the restaurant? Day.
He was born at 5 in the morning and we opened the restaurant at 5 in the evening.
Wow.
So yeah, we joke we had twins on November 18th.
How long ago was that? Like
8 years.
8 years, that's right. So do you remember the feeling of like, whoa, this is putting myself out here, you know, financially it's a little scary, like the reputation, all of that?
Absolutely. I mean, it was just like... I think it was like, this is it. You know, there are moments in life where you think that, you know, this is going to be that pivotal turn. You know, one of my favorite poems is Robert Frost, The Road Not Taken, right? And that was it, that this is the road not taken, right? This could, like, I could be driving off the cliff right now, or this could take me to Shangri-La, right? So I think... That was that, you know, feeling. But to me, I've always done that, like, you know, go big or go home, right? There is no half-assed approach to anything. Like, if I'm doing something, you'll get 200% of me, you know, 99% doesn't cut it. Yeah. So I think that was a very, it was a huge moment.
That's surely when you go big or go home, sometimes you go home.
Yeah.
What's the most painful or sort of scary moment that it didn't work?
2020, we sailed into 2020 with 4 restaurants, right? And the last one which we had opened was a Chatable. Chatable was, you know, Indian street food. So very close to Vivek and my, Vivek and I, we are business partners. Mm. It was a really crazy, you know, the financials, the projections were amazing. 2020 was going to be a year, right? Mm-hmm. And then comes March and then, like, you know, you're laying off 250 people in a day. And it just is like, we are in this industry, not only for the financial aspect of it, but also we genuinely care. Like, this is our family. We do spend time with this. I mean, with all the people. They mean a lot to us. So, like, it was just like, you know, they were a lot of evenings where, you know, I would take a pillow and a bottle of wine, go to the closet, cry my eyes out, and then come back and be mommy, because you cannot project that on your kids. So at that time, you know, and then the restaurant started opening. We did whatever we had to. Chatable never made it. Right? Because it was in a neighborhood that never came back. The thing is that even before COVID, we had made all the money back for the investors. And so we were, you know, we were in black. So when we made that decision, I tried to prolong it as much as possible. And Vivek kept on, he's like, listen, if we don't do this right now, we will dig ourselves into a hole because there is no way out of this. And I think that was really, I mean, you know, we did go big and we did go home. But
how did you and Vivek not have that in your projections?
COVID? I know.
You had 1,000 spreadsheets. How come that wasn't in one of them?
The globe that we watch into to get our projections, it didn't show that
missed
to
it.
Us.
So
I am going to, yeah, I am going to,
you need to get
blame
a new
them.
One.
Yes, yeah. our tarot card reader did not tell that to us. I'm just kidding.
Yeah. Just a couple more questions as we wrap up. How do you deal with that level of uncertainty? Because I would imagine, has that changed the way you think about future projections and certainty? And that's a cute little line on your graph there, but how do you know that's going to work out?
You don't.
Hey, this feels important. I was referencing when I said you had 1,000 spreadsheets, and I also mentioned that cute little line on your graph there when we were talking about uncertainty showing up when opening a restaurant, taking the kind of risk that Manit's relatively comfortable with. It's interesting. Risk is an arbitrary concept until you experience it. In other words, talking about getting punched in the face is completely different than actually getting punched in the face. And I think sometimes when we think about our relationship with money, and especially when we think about financial planning or spreadsheets or forecasts, we think about these beautiful lines that we draw, not realizing that that line is incredibly important and it's wrong because we don't know exactly how things will turn out. So I was super curious how Manit managed to make decisions with forecasts and then adjust to reality as it showed up.
That is the risk of running a business.
Do you feel like you knew that then, or you just know it more acutely now?
I think I knew it in the back of my mind, but I never thought that failure was an option, because in my mind, it's never been an option. but right now, I mean, as we speak, there is equipment being delivered in Disney Springs. We are opening a concept called EAT. That's, you know, Manit, so EET. And that is what gives me the heebie-jeebies, right? Like, we are looking at 1,500 people a day coming to the restaurant. Like, those numbers, we've been working on this for the last 2 years, trying to figure out, because the scale of it is so different. How we, you know, it's very different from a 150-seater restaurant, right? Which is fine dining, and this is QSR. So, but we've jumped into the deep end. I've always said that the only way to learn how to swim is jump into the deep end. And if you, you know, if you're committed enough, you will learn how to swim. And that's what we are doing. So I am aware of the fact that failure is definitely an option of whatever step you take. But if you are smart enough, you've done your homework and you don't do anything wrong, then the chances of you succeeding is higher than of you failing. But failure shouldn't be something that should deter you from taking the next step.
Yeah, that's what's fascinating to me, is like even the phrase jump into the deep end feels different. The way you say it even feels different to me than it would have felt in 2019.
True.
That's why it's called risk.
Yes.
Sometimes, you know, risk is a cute story until it shows up in your life.
Yes. Risk is a very cute story till the time the outcome is failure as opposed to success.
Yeah. Look how brave I am. I'm always taking risk. I'm always until it. Yeah. What did Mike Tyson say? Like, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face.
True.
So tell me, what does financially, like, what does enough mean to you?
I don't have an answer for that. I really don't have an answer for that. I mean, we're doing everything. It's so interesting you said that. Vivek and I, we were like, you know, we went to a retirement, like, you know, planner. And he turns, he's like, so when do you want to retire? Vivek was like, you know, 65. And I'm like, never, right? And he looks at me and we look at each other and he's like, maybe we should have had this conversation among ourselves, right? Rather than like, so our financial planner is our therapist right now.
But that happens all the time.
All the time, right?
Yeah.
And it's so...
There's something super interesting going on here. The idea of enough, I think Manit's answer was, I do not have an answer for that. And then she goes straight into this idea of retirement. For some reason, we all have in our heads that there's this default goal. And in fact, the financial planning industry has helped encourage this idea that there's this default goal of retirement. Someday where I'm going to go full gas for 30 or 40 years of my life, and then I'm going to just put on the golfing shoes. The idea of retirement is largely an outdated concept, right? We've got to have something meaningful to do. And you can hear Manit pointing to this idea that, like, I'm not going to stop building the things that I love. And I'm seeing this more and more. People looking for great hobbies. Or maybe I'm going to stop being the doctor and I'm going to go to the medical school and I'm going to teach. Or maybe I'm going to get involved in my local community center or work at the plant nursery, doing something I love. This idea of sense of purpose doesn't just stop because you reach a certain age on a calendar.
It's so interesting because, you know, we've been, and Vivek is a lot more, you know, savvier when it comes to, you know, like, you know, the stock market and investments and retirement portfolios and all of that, right? Like, you know, we're constantly discussing that. And so all of that is in place, but then, you know, with new things, there are new commitments which come, right? Like, okay, we've got kids. You know, how are we going to set them up for success, even though we want them to do it by themselves? I love traveling. And, you know, the financial planner asked us, so what are your retirement plans? I'm like, I want to travel. But I do not want to travel like how I traveled when I was a student, right? Like I want to be comfortable when I'm traveling. So there are all of these things. So I know that I'm going to work probably forever, not because I have to, because I want to, because it nourishes my soul. I enjoy. I might be like one of those really like old ladies walking, you know, into the kitchen, and maybe my contribution would be just asking how everybody is doing, right? Mm. And that's it. But to me, I think that's it. And in terms of, I don't know what enough is because I haven't come up with an answer for that.
So interesting. You're not alone. It's something we don't think that often about. And often we go straight to that same place. Like, is it a number? I'm pretty convinced enough is not a number. It's not a destination you can arrive at. It's something you have to be.
Yeah, but how can you even come up with a number? I mean, if you think about it, right? Like from the time what would have been enough for me when I was in India is a completely different number from, you know. So, you know, I'll tell you a really interesting, my sister and I, we were talking, and there are a couple of things which I'm never going to let go of, maybe because I'm an immigrant, maybe because of the fact that when I came from India, I had, you know, absolutely nothing. And I would not buy, it all comes back to a can of Coke. I would never buy Coke because it was a dollar and a dollar was worth two meals in India. Until date, I do not go to a vending machine to buy Coke because that has, you know, it's sitting in my mind. So we were planning our trip to India. You know, I was telling my sister, I said, I'm going to go to India and stuff. And the only time you can go with the kids is when they have their holidays. The tickets are absolutely ridiculously expensive, right? I mean, like, those are flights that I would, like, go ahead and, like, fly first, what they are selling for economy and taking the kids and all. So in the night, I'm like, listen, I've got to take the kids. Great. I went ahead. I bought the tickets. And I called up my sister and I'm talking to her. I'm like, think about it, that we can actually do this. Right? I'm like, I'm feeling guilty that, you know, we are spending this kind of money on tickets. But the fact that I can do it is very empowering, that it's not stopping anything from what I am doing in life by buying those tickets other than me feeling really guilty that I'm spending this kind of money, right?
Right,
I said, but the fact that I can do it and I can continue with life and I don't have to cut corners about anything that I'm doing, I'm like, that is a powerful thing. But that is it. I think that that goal of what is enough keeps on changing. I mean, think about inflation, right? Like all of that will keep on changing. And yeah, I think there's a big part of me which doesn't want to come up with a number or a point where enough is enough, because maybe I'm afraid that I will stop pushing myself to do more because I have been satiated. And I don't want to ever reach that level of satisfaction because that might make me stop pushing myself. I know it's so screwed up, but you know what?
No, it's not.
That's,
it's beautiful.
That's what it is.
Like, no, I was literally just thinking that's so beautiful because if I get this right, pushing yourself and doing is about the expression of a craft. It's about the expression of an art. It's you've got a really strong opinion about something you want to see in the world.
True.
And there's nothing wrong with that. I think you've just defined enough. Like it to me, it's not a number. It can't be, because it will never, if it's a number, you'll never have enough, right? It's just almost a state of being like, I want to have permission to keep, I want to give myself permission to keep doing the thing, right? So let's pretend like it's 20 years from now and I'm still doing the show and your daughter's 29 and, right? And your son is 6 now?
No, my son is 8 and my daughter is 12.
Oh, so your daughter's 32
yeah.
And your son's 28. Let's say I have them both on the show as guests. And I ask them what money means to them. Like, what would you hope they would say?
I would hope that they would say what they've learned from money is building character, right? It is building strength. It is, money doesn't replace emotions or human value, but it is something that shows how you are evolving as a person. You know, in India, you know, there are gods and goddesses for everything. There is a goddess for money, right? And that is how money is treated in India, right? There is reverence to it, right? Like for Diwali, you know, you're inviting Goddess Lakshmi to come home, right? There is reverence to money. And that is a reverence that needs to be given to money, because that's what builds you as a person, as a human being, as a future citizen of the world.
Yeah, all I can say is amen.
And I'm going to tell them that when you interview them, when they are, you know, 20 years down, that they better say this. I'll give them $5 each right now. See, I am going to bribe them. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, that's Mani. That's so beautiful. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you.
I can't wait to come to Nashville, right?
Yes, Nashville.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. This was so much fun.
I'm super curious how you feel after listening to that. You know, often when we talk about money, we are in our heads, right? We're doing calculations and spreadsheets and even maybe using the abacus, right? But I'm really curious about how you feel after listening to that, because I was struck by two things. Number one, this sense of joy, right? Even from the very beginning of our conversation, about growing up in India as a girl child, there was this sense of joy and playfulness, which I felt. And the second thing was right there at the end, this idea of reverence for money. And I want to just point something out. This sense of reverence, which I think is so important, and it gets lost because money becomes this arbitrary concept, this idea like a piece of paper or zeros and ones in a bank account. And in that exchange, we forget what it really is. Remember, you traded a bit of your life for that money, your time, your attention. And that time and attention could have been used somewhere else.
right? That tension, the tension between what you decide to trade your time and attention for and how you use your money, I think it deserves reverence. I think if we can get clear about that, that money is not just electronic X's and O's in a bank account. Money is something that we should have reverence for. Those are the two things that I felt in this conversation with Manit. What did you feel? My friends, can I make a little suggestion? We need more conversations like this happening out in the world. So share this. Think of it as a little opportunity to start your own book club around this podcast. Share it with a friend, a family member. What kind of conversations can you start having around the reverence and the joy that we might be able to feel around money? Cheers. I'm looking forward to the next conversation with you at 50 Fires. 50 Fires is a production of Blind Nil Audio in association with The Roost. My friends, if you find this show valuable, share it with a friend and leave a 6 or 7 star review on Apple Podcasts. It's crazy how much that helps the show get introduced to larger audiences. I'm Carl Richards. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll see you around the fire for our next episode.
The views, information, or opinions expressed in the series are solely those of the individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of Chip and Joanna Gaines, Blind Nil Audio, nor Magnolia.